This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Anna Carnegie. Anna is a research fellow at King's College London, where she supports the Eating Disorder Clinical Research Network, or EDCRN, and lends support to the UK Eating Disorder Genetics Initiative, or EDGIA UK. Alongside her academic role, Anna brings her own lived experience of OCD, anorexia, and long-term recovery. She now uses that experience to shape research, advocate for better funding, and push for eating disorder studies that truly centre the people they're supposed to help. It was really lovely to speak to Anna about the research that she's doing, both with EDCRN and EDGI. It was also fantastic to hear from Anna how she now uses her lived experience in a research role, demonstrating how important lived experience is, and that just because you've had your own experience doesn't mean that you can't work in that research position. I really hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Anna Carnegie, and it's lovely to have you on the podcast. How are you doing, Anna?
I'm doing really well. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, I've said this quite a few times recently, but I seem to be doing podcasts with people recently that I'm like, how have we not already done this? Like, I've known you for years and we're only just getting around to it. So it's very nice to finally be chatting to you.
Better late than never.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Did you want to introduce yourself to start with?
Sure. So my name is Anna Carnegie, and I currently work as a research fellow at King's College London, where I coordinate a large-scale project called the Eating Disorders Clinical Research Network. I also support the EDGI UK study, that's the Eating Disorders Genetics Initiative, which some of the listeners might be familiar with. And I come to both of those roles and projects with my own lived experience of an eating disorder and being in long-term recovery from that. So yeah, I guess various things for us to touch on today.
And I think in my head, I knew that you did both of those things. But when I read it written down on paper, I was like, are they not two of like the biggest eating disorder studies and you're doing both of them?
Yeah, they're full on. I will say my role on EDGI is more in a supporting part. Mm-hmm. I think they dovetail quite nicely together. So my main responsibilities are on EDCRN, the Eating Disorders Clinical Research Network, which we can get into what that's about. But they're both really large and exciting projects. And in a field where there's really like an absence of much research and investment in research. It's not that there's not research happening. There's some amazing people doing some amazing things, but the investment behind it isn't comparable to, say, other mental health conditions, or pales into insignificance when you think of the investment that goes into physical health. So it's really exciting to be part of such big initiatives in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the sad reality, isn't it, of the discrepancy of money put into different health conditions compared to eating disorders. Was that something that you were working on the other day? I think it was. I was reading something and I think it was saying like it was like £1.33 or something is put into eating disorder research. Was that something you'd done?
Yes, we've recently done some work where we have asked people from various walks of life, those researching eating disorders, working in eating disorders with their own lived experience. Obviously, those groups overlap quite significantly. Their views on the need for increasing investment in eating disorders research. Why we're not seeing that? What are the reasons behind that? I guess like I've got my views on that. I'm sure you have your views on that. We want to hear from other people. So that's why we ask them. And we really want to get people behind pushing forward some key messaging that we can take to government and funding bodies and really say this is actually what we need to see. We need a coherent, substantial investment in eating disorders research. We've got some really amazing smaller funders that are really committed to the area, but they simply just don't have the resources to fund everything or to fund really big, meaty projects like EDCRN or your EDGYs. We need more of that, and we're so hampered in what we know about eating disorders and how we can treat them and support people without that investment. So it really starts from the research.
Yeah. And I often feel like it's the general knowledge within the eating disorder community is sometimes better than maybe what's out there in the written literature, because people have their lived experience and have those conversations with people. And because the research isn't available or isn't funded, those conversations that people are having in their kind of lived experience groups is increasing knowledge rather than it being in a journal.
100%. And I think that's something that makes me really optimistic is we are seeing, and I think the eating disorders field is a really good example of that. Actually, we are seeing a lot more involvement from people with lived experience. There's still a lot of barriers for people that are directly affected to contribute to research, but we are seeing a lot more willingness from funders and from research groups, I think, and a lot more awareness about the need to actually co-produce some of this stuff. And I think we forget that there's many of us, like myself, that occupy both positions and can actually bring both into our day-to-day roles and into the projects. And I know for me, I feel like I definitely wouldn't be able to do the job that I do or do it as well if I didn't have my own personal experience of an eating disorder. And so I really see, and the team that I work with also really see, both through my case and through other people, just like how much value add there is for progressing the field when you have people who've been there and lived it actually driving stuff, rather than just being kind of, consulted at the end or, sent a presentation or something or sent the journal article that's really inaccessible. It's like actually going back to people and saying, well, what do you think the key gaps are? What should we be doing? And what do you think of these ideas? And actually making sure that shapes the work going forward, because as you say, there's so much happening in the community. There's such a strong base there that it's really valuable to see that feeding through to research more and more.
Definitely. And I think, I don't know, I guess it's probably similar in all medical conditions, but to me, it does feel like there's a an even more powerful role of lived experience within eating disorder research and support. And I don't know whether that's maybe because of all the misconceptions and the stigma that even sometimes clinicians may have around eating disorders. To have that lived experience is really valuable. But I just wondered, from your perspective, what do you think is some of the most valuable aspects of, you know, you having your own lived experience and then in the role that you do?
I think it's bringing that kind of human element, even the kind of little things. So I remember recently on putting together a grant, we were talking about like the acceptability of basically doing some particular intervention and being able to explain to the co-investigators of that grant why I thought that it was a good or not so good idea and how it could be changed to be made better, and being able to share, well, this is my experience. This is what people in treatment would have felt about X thing happening. And that really, I think, added credence to the research. It made the research it made the application stronger and better. I think also there is so much stigma, and there is so much, I think we can all use terminology and kind of, yes, speak about illnesses. And in particular, I think there's just a particular sensitivity around speaking about eating disorders, that having some lived experience input on, well, actually, this is how that makes me feel when I see these terms. I think, again, that's something that's, you don't really maybe see as much in the physical health space, and actually does just make people reflect a little more on things that, like, terms that they might have used without even thinking, or ideas that they might have had without even thinking, like ideas about eating disorder recovery and what that means. Like, there's so many, I think the biggest thing is, like, it brings nuance to the discussion where there isn't always. And I'm not saying that academics and clinicians aren't nuanced. They very much are. But it's a different kind of appreciation you can have when you've actually lived through it, or you've supported a child or a partner through it. Even using that example of recovery, and what is that actually an academic interpretation traditionally is going to be, like, very rigid, and it has to be X thing. Whereas actually, you speak to anyone with lived experience, the vast majority of us are going to say, like, who knows? That's a big question. It's the biggest question.
Often in a clinical setting, it's, you know, you maybe reach a certain weight, or you've opened your variety of foods up to a set number. Whereas actually, I've had so many conversations about recovery on this podcast, and it's so different for everybody. And I think one thing that I reflect on maybe more so over the past couple of years, more than when I first, like, got into working in this space, is the range of voices that we actually have now. And I remember going to a conference.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
That Dr. Chooks had set up, and we all kind of were sat around listening to the conference. We had lunch, and then someone spoke after lunch, and he was kind of new to the field. He'd not really opened up about his eating disorder before. And he said, can I just, like, talk about the elephant in the room, in that we were all just asked to eat lunch together and no one said anything, and we're at an eating disorder conference and everyone's faces was like, oh, I can't believe he's just said that. But I was just sat there like, that really makes sense. Like,
yes.
You know, I always, maybe this is wrong of me to think, but when you go to a like an eating disorder event and they've got biscuits, even if somebody hasn't got lived experience of an eating disorder, I think people are often thinking in their mind, like, should I eat them? Shouldn't I eat them? And for someone to just say it, I was like, we're all thinking it. And I really appreciate those new voices coming in that maybe don't have the kind of fear, or they're not holding back because they're like, oh my God, if I say that, that's going to trigger somebody.
Mm-hmm. And just that awareness of, yeah, I will do a plug for the EDAC Consortium, Edinburgh. Every year that we're all funded from the same funding, big funding pot, and every year a group hosts, and they hosted last year. And just the sensitivity with which, like, they obviously have peer research on their embedded in their team, but also their team are just really great. But the sensitivity with which they approached food, like communicating openly of these are the options, like in advance, these are the options, you can come, go, do whatever, you can take that hour if you like just simple things like that, that I think a lot of people just doesn't occur to them. And I can see, like, if you haven't lived through it, you're not necessarily going to think that as the first port of call, but it's those seemingly little things that are actually kind of massive. Especially, yeah, in the case of someone where it's like, you've got lunch and then you're the first speaker after lunch. That's, yeah, it's a lot to contend with. I think it is just little moments like that, that actually, that's another example that I think of, like, I really think that obviously I was a recipient of that comms rather than being involved in the decision making. But I suspect that there is some lived experience input went into that side of things. So I think the more honesty and transparency we can have about the process and the, like, yeah, this is awkward. And I know for me, when I started my role, I was a little bit hesitant to kind of be open about those things, or like, well, I'm comfortable with this thing, maybe a little bit less so. And because I had this self-imposed, you know, the like expectation of, you've said that you've been out of treatment for X amount of time, you must be like 100% fine, and you must present as that all the way through. And that's not at all what my team would have expected. And I think when I did open up, they're like, oh my God, of course not. Of course it's fine. And it made it so much easier because I didn't feel like I was having to hide things. But I think sometimes, yeah, there is that temptation to be this like perfect vision of recovery. And the more we can kind of complicate that a little bit, and the more people you have doing that complicating and having those conversations, just, yeah, the better it'll be for us as a whole.
I think one thing I've always thought about, and why I've always been so open about my experience on the podcast, is that I completely understand when people don't want to necessarily share their personal experience because it's personal to them. So it may be something that they don't want to share. But my perspective has always been, if I hold back from sharing it because I'm worried about what people will think of me, or kind of scared about their response, that's kind of giving the message that there's something to be ashamed of, or that there's kind of some sort of stigma there that I'm internalizing. And so my perspective has always been, if I share, somebody else that's struggling might think, oh, I can actually talk about that and I don't need to be ashamed.
Mm-hmm. I really get that. And I think for me, definitely it was a teasing out and testing out, like, when it felt appropriate or not. There were definitely times where I didn't share my own lived experience. And then afterwards I was like, actually, you know what? I think it would have been beneficial for me to make that person aware of that, because it would have maybe made them feel less alone.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things as well that, like, it's completely up to you as to how much you share, when you share. You know, it's not like saying, well, because you now have a lived experience role, you have to share all the time and you have to share your full story. I think there's obviously still, you know, it's completely up to you, but also from a professional perspective, you learn to know when sharing is actually beneficial to the conversation or when sharing is just for sharing's sake.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think it's something that needs to be a skill that needs to be honed. And I will say I came into this job kind of in the abstract thinking, because it was my first lived experience role. It was my first role working in eating disorders. I'd been working in completely different fields prior to that. So coming in, I was like, yeah, theoretically, I know there's going to be some of these things come up. I don't think I was prepared for how much I need to confront that or the different scenarios that come up when you're, yeah, working in something that you also have direct experience of. It brings up quite a lot of, yeah, just conundrums and things to work through, which actually, like, as tricky as they are at the time, I found that it's been really great because I've really grown, I think, from that. But I recognize that as a field, peer research is much earlier days. And so we're having some of those initial conversations, like some of us who work in the field and are doing either formal or informal peer research type roles have come together and tried to tease out, okay, what are the challenges? How can we as people who are in these positions advocate for our own needs whilst also kind of providing some resources or kind of signposting research groups to, yeah, how might you deal with having a peer researcher on your team? It's all well and good saying, oh yeah, we want to embed this, and then not having the mechanisms of like inviting them out to lunch on their first day unplanned at a random place and expecting them to be fine with it kind of thing, or not like considering that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's definitely a field that is emerging, which is amazing, but there's a lot still to be done to kind of, yeah, support the peer researchers themselves and the teams that they're embedded within.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's such an important thing to consider, because the role of a peer researcher or somebody that's got lived experience is so valuable. But as you said, you're also asking them to discuss quite challenging or difficult situations from their past. And I know in my experience, it has been a fantastic thing to do. But as you've said, it sometimes does highlight maybe where your recovery isn't as advanced or as concrete as you maybe expected. And that's, as you know, that's sometimes a good thing, because it's like, okay, there's still further work to do here, and it kind of pinpoints where they are rather than you kind of being blind to that. But also there's got to be a structure and support in place for that, to know that at the end of the day you're asking people to relive sometimes things that they've been through, and they may need extra support than a researcher who's doing something that they haven't also lived through.
Yeah, it's the emotional burden that it requires on people to share. And this hasn't been the case in my experience, but I do know that there's people in those roles who have been put in situations where it's almost been expected of them to share and like be kind of like the poster child for eating disorders and be expected to represent all eating disorders in this one person and this one experience. And you can't do that. And so, yeah, there's so much that needs to be thought through in terms of the support that we're providing to these people who are like bringing really valuable skill set. But it is a much more, I guess, intrusive, I would say, skill set, in that it requires you to really like dig deep in a way that, as you say, for I guess like a researcher who's come just from the outside, it isn't really comparable.
Yeah. And I really want to get onto your lived experience, and I've been meaning to for the past 20 minutes, but I keep just having more questions to ask you. I guess just, you said there that, you know, there's things that people need to put into place to ensure that people with lived experience are being supported. And I suppose that feels like a really important thing to kind of expand on in terms of, from your experience, what would you say those things are, in case people are listening that are, that they do have people with lived experience engaged in their research or their services?
I would say that transparency and acknowledging, like, openly at the start of someone joining a team, what are your red lines? Like, what do you need? What do you not need? What would be helpful? How do you want to approach things like food? How do you want to approach things like if you're in a meeting and it's your former treatment team, or you find yourself in a call with a former fellow patient? How do we navigate those scenarios? Are there things that you don't want to be involved in? Rather than, for example, not involving someone in something because you think this isn't going to be helpful for them, this is going to be harmful, having that proactive conversation of what do you want? And that can change, and that's okay. And then also having a bit of that well-being psychological support kind of built in as like almost a, I know peer support workers will, and clinicians will have that supervision kind of piece built into their day-to-day, and having something comparable where there is a person or persons on the team that you know you can check in with if you're having a hard time with, yeah, something in the role or there's other things going on. Also a recognition. I think it comes back to that upfront communication around we're not expecting like grade A, tip-top, 100% recovery, or at least guess we shouldn't be, because that's not the reality of many mental health conditions, including eating disorders. There are going to be peaks and troughs, and actually that's okay. We can put things in place. It's okay if you need to take time out. It's okay if there are things that this week you're struggling with more than last week, we can adapt. I think all of that to say, just having the open and honest conversations, going back to your first example, like bringing up the elephant in the room.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
If research teams can do that proactively and not be scared of it, I think that's super valuable.
Speaking of your lived experience, it would be really nice if you were happy to share, to talk about your lived experience and then how that kind of got you into the role that you're now doing, or roles, should I say.
Yeah, it is a nice perfect circle in a way, in some ways, as perfect a circle as an eating disorder can be, I guess. So my experience, I am Irish, I grew up in Ireland, experienced OCD from quite a young age, although I wasn't diagnosed and I didn't know what it was. I just thought that I was bad for having these thoughts and having rituals internally around them. Like I had fears about various things. And I didn't tell anyone this, and it kind of went on until I was about 15, when that developed into an eating disorder. It developed into anorexia. I was formally diagnosed a year later, and then had various treatment episodes in Dublin, both as an inpatient and an outpatient, and everything in between of there not being enough beds and my parents being sent home in a panic and various things. Had good and bad experiences. I would say that the inpatient admissions were, while there were some great staff there, my experience with that particular service in Dublin wasn't amazing. I had some good private therapy. I then moved to London when I was 22, and I had kind of maintained a functional eating disorder, but started to, so I had a lot of behaviors. I was well enough to be out of hospital, seem like a functioning human, but not really participate in life. So not, yeah, go to college, have friends, but not give it 100%, I would say. I started to decline in my health in my last year of university, which is around the same time that I moved to London. That culminated in an emergency admission in 2012 to an NHS service who were incredible and would say absolutely saved my life in every way. They were phenomenal and really supported me. I think previously all of the treatment I had had, or the vast majority of it anyway, was on physical rehabilitation, and that's it. You're like weight restoring, and that's basically the end of the story. Eat your meals and your snacks, that's it. Whereas this treatment experience was the polar opposite. It was like, what are your goals for life? We'll help you to get there. There was psychoeducation, there was practical support. I had forgotten how to do, or hadn't really known how to do, basic things like what is a normal meal, what does cooking for oneself actually look like, and that kind of stuff really, really helped me. And I won't say that it got me to 100% like full recovery, however different people define that, and but complete absence of symptoms and thoughts, I don't think it got me the whole way, but it enabled me to lead a life that I never thought that I would have been able to lead. Enabled me to build relationships, to work, proper kind of healthy approach to life and manage my emotions in a better way. I have had subsequent outpatient experiences, treatment experiences since then, but have generally been in stable recovery. I haven't had an inpatient admission since 2013, which for me is, yeah, a world away from what my life looked like when I was in my 20s. As part of that treatment, I went to the campus at KCL, gave a blood sample. That project was called Charlotte's Helix. It was set up by a patient care organization, well, a woman and attached to an organization, and I think was the impetus or part of the impetus for the Eating Disorders Genetics Initiative, which launched nearly 10 years later in 2020. I took part in EDGY at the time that it launched as well. I had heard researchers like Cindy Bulick prior to that talking about some of the findings from what Charlotte's Helix went into and informed, which is the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative. And it really just kind of hit home with me, a lot of what was being said, a lot of because I had always had the experience of I would leave treatment and have been weight restored and everything, and then something would happen. I wouldn't really mean to always, but I would lose weight and then I would just kind of, the thoughts would come back and the compulsions would come back. And what Cindy Bulick was talking about was the genetics and metabolic component in some eating disorders, and that really just kind of validated what I'd been experiencing. They also found what may seem obvious to people, but again was really validating to me, was around the links with things like OCD, which I had experienced in like myself, there'd been schizophrenia and other things in my family. So seeing like how this all genetically played out made a lot of sense. So then I took part in EDGY. Didn't really think much more about that. COVID then happened around the same time, so that kept me occupied. In 2023, then I was looking for a change, and I came across this job for a study coordinator for this new, really exciting initiative called the EDCRN, or Eating Disorders Clinical Research Initiative or Network. And the EDCRN is a project that is working with NHS and non-NHS eating disorder services across the UK to collect standardized data with and from patients and caregivers about eating disorder presentations, treatment, outcomes. And what that basically means is that if your service is part of EDCRN, you'll get the same questionnaires, which you'll complete online throughout your treatment, similar to, like, for me, when I was in treatment, it was paper form and they just handed it out to you and I never really knew where it went. But you'll do that at a time of your choosing. And crucially, everyone who's part of the network or who's in a service that's part of the network, which is why we're trying to get as many services involved as possible, they will all have the same questionnaires. So not only will doing this kind of help people within their treatment, because you'll be able to have that discussion. The idea is that clinical team will get access to this information. They'll have access to kind of graphs to kind of see how people are progressing, not just on things like a weight chart, but on other outcome measures as well. Obviously, I know a lot of clinicians do that already, but my experience in treatment certainly was that I'd fill in all these questionnaires and then they'd go into an ether somewhere and, yeah, we'd look at the BMI chart and that'd be it. But it will fundamentally, and going back to my point at the start, also enable us to, in a secure way, using the anonymized data from people in the network, we'll be able to look at things like what treatments are people getting across the UK, what's working, what's having the best outcomes for different groups. Obviously, the more people that we have who are part of the network, the more we can do in terms of digging into, is X treatment performing better than Y treatment for people with binge eating disorder, for example, and answering some of those questions that actually, like, quite maybe basic questions in other fields that for eating disorders, we just don't have the data. We don't have that information in a standardized way. Everyone's doing slightly different things and all recording things in a slightly different way. So I heard about this project, was immediately fascinated by it and taken by it. And so I applied. I had known about the links with EDGY, but I found out that Professor Jerome Breen, who leads the EDGY UK initiative, also co-leads EDCRN along with Karina Allen. I now work with them. So it's been a really nice coming back around. I hadn't actually realized that the building that I work in is also the building that I visited in 2013 to provide my blood sample as part of Charlotte's Helix. So that was, a nice kind of moment of reflection of, actually, I'm in the right place, I'm doing the right thing, and this is what it was all for.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, that's such a lovely full circle. And I think, you know, an eating disorder is, if we're being frank, such a shit thing to live with, to then be able to use that for the better. And I don't know about you, but I always find, right, because it's something that's happened to me, like, it's very interesting and you want to know more about it. So there's that personal gain in there as well of, like you said, you know, you've had OCD, you've got schizophrenia in your family, like learning about those genetic elements, it helps you put those puzzle pieces together a bit more and be able to say, ah, yeah, you know, this makes more sense now. So I think that's fantastic. And it made me giggle what you said also about, you know, the kind of things that you're answering through the network. Like, you would think that they would be things that we might know already, but unfortunately we don't. But, you know, if we look at that from a positive perspective, thank goodness that you are now looking at that. And I'm really pleased to hear as well that it is a range of eating disorders rather than it just being, I wasn't sure if the research was just anorexia, particularly edgy, because I did the edgy one where you did the saliva sample. Obviously, I had anorexia, so I didn't know if it was for other eating disorders, but it's great to hear that other things are being looked at as well.
Absolutely. And I will say that while EDCRN is working with services, so participants are people who are receiving treatment for any eating disorder, edgy goes even broader.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
So edgy is open to anyone, currently just in England, but watch this space. With any eating disorder, you don't need a diagnosis to take part. So if you have experience with any eating disorder, you are eligible to take part in edgy. And yeah, it is a questionnaire, again, that you can complete in your own time. It is, I won't sugarcoat it, it's a long questionnaire. It goes into quite a lot of detail. There's quite a lot of questions to fill in. But I think the reason why we ask all of those things is so that we can then find out it precisely that, all of that information that we don't have the answers to at the moment that we should have the answers to. And then obviously with people providing the little saliva sample and posting that back to us, it means that we can then also bring in the genetic element, which is a really exciting and promising, yeah, area of research. So if anyone is contemplating participating in edgy and hasn't already done so, or has done so and hasn't sent their kit back, please do.
Yes, I do know that that was me for quite a long time.
I mean,
reapplying for another one, I've been like, oh my God, I actually need to send this. I must ask though, have you kind of seen any genetic links?
So they have discovered several gene loci that are, so far, the findings are contained to anorexia because it's part of this larger sample that's the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative. But there's also some really promising research coming out about binge eating disorder, which is indicating kind of reverse metabolic link, like different metabolic links for people with binge eating disorder. I will say, I am not a geneticist, so I can't speak to it as fluently as some of my colleagues can, or even attempt. But it is really exciting because it does show both the the environmental and the psychological implications, but also these metabolic components. So I think that's one thing that maybe people are often hesitant about when they hear about genetics research, that it's saying that, like, oh, your genetics will prove that you have this, like the anorexia gene or the binge eating disorder gene. It's not that. It is that there's certain people who are maybe more vulnerable genetically, but that's not the whole picture. That's one small part of the picture. There is also all of these other factors. There's the environment you grow up in. There is the risk that you are exposed to, be that trauma, be that food insecurity, be that grief. That also, I think there's a really nice way that some of our team and former team have illustrated it, that it's a jar and it's the kind of, you put things into the jar, which are the vulnerabilities, but you can also take stuff out of that jar and put other things in. So putting in a support network, things like hobbies or therapy, detracts from the risk.
I am also not a geneticist, so I appreciate the non-geneticist language. But I think that's really interesting what you said. And, you know, I think hopefully people are understanding that more nowadays, that an eating disorder is not caused by one specific thing. And I really like that jar analogy. But I guess, and you may not know the answer to this, but this is just me getting really intrigued in this now. In terms of the like genetic research or like the genetic element, let's say, like, if there's a genetic illness that, I don't know, my mum had, for example, and then they knew that my mum had it, then because she had it and it's potentially hereditary, I would then maybe be screened for it. And then there might be preventative measures, or there might be some form of treatment that I can have that would kind of stop me getting, kind of thing. Is that what the idea is with noticing these genetical elements? Is it to kind of screen people when they're young, or is there kind of alternative ideas?
I think it's both. It's around like prevention and treatment, but definitely being able to identify, like, edgy, the sample of participants we have are people with eating disorders, but the more that we know about what the potential risks are, the more we can inform and build those into prevention strategies. So as you say, if there are certain things that will pose an additional risk, regardless of someone's environment, then are there things that we can put in, like put into that jar proactively to try and mitigate against the fact that that might be something that they go on to develop? So ultimately, yes, but then it's also about supporting those people who are actively struggling and what treatments actually might work well for people, depending on their individual circumstances. And that's kind of, yeah, how it marries up with EDCRN too, is that we are trying to look at, actually, we know there's been so much talked about that one size fits all approach doesn't actually fit all. We need to be more personalized in how we approach these things, but we don't yet have sufficient information to be able to make those judgments with people on how we might do that. And these research projects will ultimately, our aim is that they will help us achieve that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's such an important thing, isn't it? That there is no one size fits all in terms of treatment. And I think that for me is becoming even more of a thing, you know, the more that we're starting to understand the link between eating disorders and neurodiversity, or as you've mentioned, OCD, even then, just because somebody's autistic or just because somebody has ADHD doesn't necessarily mean that that like a particular form of treatment is always going to work. And so I think it's often, you know, seeing that individual as the individual that they are and exploring different treatment modalities with them. But as you said, you know, the more we can understand about what different services are offering, what is having a beneficial outcome, you know, maybe that some services are doing things that other services have never even thought of, but actually it's proving to be really beneficial. Like you mentioned about like having support in preparing a meal, knowing how much to prepare. I can imagine that some services, it literally comes down to having a, you know, medical monitoring appointment and being given a meal plan, but no kind of actual life skills that for so often are so important for people with eating disorder, because either they've not needed to do that because they've been in inpatient care, or they've had somebody else doing it for them because they've been being cared for. So, you know, seeing that bigger picture, I think, is so important.
Absolutely. And I think that was one thing that I didn't mention before when I was talking about my experience and what was so positive about it was it actually did feel tailored to me in that I remember being able to try different things. I was told what therapies were on offer and they were all offered kind of as soon as it was safe to do so and introduce me to them, and that I could try out, I tried dance and movement therapy and art therapy and different things, and I could kind of decide this isn't really for me, but this I'm actually stuff that I wouldn't like. I dance and movement therapy was probably the one example that I was like, oh no way. And then I went to it, I was like, oh actually I really chime with this. There was a recognition that not everything is going to work for everyone. Like, yeah, certainly for me, like body image groups never really felt like something that really helped me. And I know that they help tons of people, but the fact that I could be like, actually, this is my space that I'm going to do the other one, was really valued. I think if we can like use data to support that, but ultimately I do think having that kind of patient informed, this is what works for me, you're seeing me as a person, you're actually meeting me on my level. It also goes against some of the other like real issues with some treatment experiences where the patient is almost dehumanized. I mean, even me saying patient, like the person is dehumanized in that interaction, and the like even best case scenario, the parents are deferred to, and yeah, it might be someone who's 27 years old and can actually make that decision themselves. I think that all feeds into actually how are we treating this person? We're treating the person for the eating disorder. They are not the eating disorder. I think it all, the more you can give people choice and autonomy and yeah, just respect over how their treatment goes, I think like the easier and more successful it will be for everyone.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's what I would really hope from the research that you're doing, is it's kind of, it's opening up the possibilities of treatment or our understanding of eating disorders, so that we've got more options to lean into, as opposed to being like, right, well, the most successful treatment was this one, therefore this is the only one we're going to use. I think, you know, if it's looking at it from like a, oh, these things have been really successful for people, like, so that they, I mean, then you come onto the issue of resources and funding and all that nonsense, but that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
But I think if we're able to, you know, increase our understanding and look at it from an individual level in terms of how that eating disorder is showing up for somebody and the impact it's having on their life, then I think that's a real step into more supportive care.
100%. Because it's, yeah, highly unlikely that one treatment is going to be amazing for everyone. We're all very, very different people. We've been talking earlier about, yeah, responses to certain things. So we're going to need different things. And yes, the resources conversation is definitely another podcast. But hopefully this will pave the way for like setting a roadmap, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Anna. It's honestly been such a pleasure to speak to you and hear about all the work that you're doing and your experience. I will put all of the links to the respective organisations and to get in touch with you in the show notes. But thank you so much for joining me.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.